Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. Hi, Spanners here. The good news is we've got some great midweek content for you again. We've got an interview with one of the most recognisable names in F1 media. The bad news is Alex Van Gien is also here. Hello, Alex.
Hello, from my mother-in-law's house, where I have literally turned up with all my stuff, laid it on the table, said, bye, I'm leaving you alone for the rest of the evening to come see you lot.
We appreciate your sacrifice because we are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed. With the kind permission of our better halves, we aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. Tonight, we're joined by Formula One presenter and journalist. It's Will Buxton joining us in the shed. Will, thanks so much for dropping in.
Oh, absolute pleasure. It's lovely to be back in the shed. It's been a while. I see you've got some new tools, some old tools in the shape of Van Gien. It's lovely to be back, mate.
Firstly, can I check before we get going, can I check that you're not wearing any jewellery, you don't have any body piercings, and all your underwear is podcast appropriate?
It is, yes. I am actually wearing underwear, not that you can see on this Zoom, but I've got some jewellery, but you're allowed to keep a wedding ring on.
Is that
right?
I've
got an engagement ring, so I guess that kind of, that's the same. And I've got a ring that my daughter gave me when she was like 2 years old that I've never taken off. So FIA can do one. That's staying on.
Yeah. No one tells Buxton to take off his daughter's ring thing.
Exactly. Yes. Well, that and more controversy, I'm sure, to come our way in the next however long we're going to be here.
So I couldn't be bothered to stay up for free practice one in Australia because it's far away. But when I woke up and started tuning in, everyone was talking about underwear and jewellery and body piercings. And whilst it may feel like a glib question, I think it lends to the broader topic of race control that they felt the need to specifically start talking about everyone's pants and jewellery.
Yeah, I think it's a shot across the bows, isn't it? It's kind of new headmaster starts at school and starts really just clamping down on everything to say, look, if you think that I'm being pernickety about this and you think I'm getting on your ass about this, well, just wait till you really step out of line. And it kind of, I think they're trying to show that they've really looked through the rule book. They've gone through it all with a fine tooth comb and they're going to stick to the letter of the law. You know, from race one, boom, white line is the side of the track. That's it. We don't need to tell you this anymore. That's the rule. We're going to stick to it. And I kind of like that. I like that it's just clear, it's concise, and it's, you know, so I think it's just a message of intent shot across the bows right from day one.
I mean, to be honest, with regards to the jewelry thing, that they use that rule as low down as like rental carting.
It's not a new rule.
Exactly. It's that whole case of everyone's throwing their arms up in the air because they think it's aimed particularly at Lewis. However, one of my favourite comments from Lewis was, "I've got piercings you can't see." It makes me wonder if he's got a Prince Albert, but that'd be weird.
All right, we're not explaining that one to anyone. But yeah, to be fair,
I thought you were talking about the Monaco Grand Prix. Anyway, let's move
a lot of people did kick off saying, "Is this specifically aimed at Lewis Hamilton because he's known for liking his jewellery and his fashion?"
Yeah, but it was the first time it came up, I remember being about 10 years ago. And at that point, it was like, is this solely aimed at Tony Oliuzzi because he's got an eyebrow piercing?
Okay.
So, you know what? It's like same arguments back then. But, you know, the same thing about the fireproof underwear.
Yeah.
You don't be wearing nylon pants, you know, if you're in the middle of a fire, because if everything else is fireproof, but your pants set on fire, that's no good. And you know what? I remember about a decade ago, we were at the Nürburgring and Charlie Whiting sent an edict out to the teams, and he basically said, look, 3/4 of you are running overalls that are not FIA compliant, because the compliance patch that goes on the back of the collar that, you know, you all see on every set of overalls that you have has to be stitched on as to the letter of the regulations, not ironed on, because it could burn away or, you know, burn up if it got into a fire. So these ones that had been printed on were basically contrary to the regulations. And so Charlie was like, well, I'm not going to let you get in the cars and go out until you've got sewn on patches. And it was something really, really basic, but I quite like that. I just, you know, here's the rules, stick to them. And now we know where we're at. Black and white. It's what we need.
It sort of reminds me of those old rock and roll stars that would have their rider that would make very weird claims like M&Ms, but take out all the brown ones.
Yeah.
It's sort of a way to check that they've got everyone's attention.
A little bit. As I said, I think it's just like, you know, headmaster, new headmaster at a school, first week in, just being like, you know, proper hard ass in the first week, just to lay down the law of, I'm here, I'm in charge, don't mess around.
And it's kind of cool. It's a bit weird that, you know, we're into April, and really the first we've heard of this dramatic change in race control, the first time they've really got our attention is talking about everyone's cruds. So I guess that speaks to things having gone quite well so far. But Toto Wolff was recently openly very critical of Michael Massey, using very strong language, which I wouldn't ask you to comment on, but just calling him a liability, saying he didn't respond to feedback. Have things settled noticeably? Like, are people happy?
Not online.
No, I didn't mean the internet.
No one's ever happy online.
Yeah, I didn't mean the internet, Will.
That's a whole different thing. Yes, no, completely. You know, I think, obviously, there's still a lot of hurt. There's still a lot of negative feeling about the way in which the end of last season played out. I think, you know, on both sides of the championship fight, because, you know, Max doesn't deserve to have an asterisk put against his name, in my opinion. You know, I think he's a worthy world champion.
Alex, be quiet. We've had our say.
And I think that what happened in the final race, you know, it left a very bitter taste for Mercedes and Mercedes fans and Lewis fans. But it's also left a bit of a bitter taste for Verstappen and for Verstappen's fans and Red Bull's fans, because what should have been a, you know, a triumphant victory in the world championship has ultimately been sort of taken away from them. They haven't been able to celebrate it and enjoy it as much as they should have been able to. So, yeah, I think, look, new season, new people in charge, and not just in race control, but at the very top of the FIA. So, you know, anytime that you jump online at the moment and say, oh, you know, the FIA is doing X, Y, and Z, and people turn around and they say, oh, yeah, but what happened in Abu Dhabi? It's like, it's like going to an election, a new government coming in, and the new government turning around and saying, well, we're going to do this. And they say, well, you didn't do it 6 months ago. It's like, well, we weren't in power 6 months ago. Shut up. Like, you know, it's a new broom. Give them time. Stop referring everything back to last year. It's a very different group of people who are A, in charge of the FIA, and B, sitting in race control.
Yeah, Alex, it was last year, Van Gien.
To be fair, it's interesting, the whole thing about last year. And I've, you know, I'm never going to forget it, and I'm still going to always be a little bit miffed about it, but I've very much taken the stance of, okay, that's done now. It's not going to change. There's no point me spending energy being mad about it. When, especially because 2022 has started and it's been a great start to the season.
We've got some
really amazing things going on. Let's focus energy and positivity on that rather than looking back at negativity of something you can't change. It was bad. It happened, but there's nothing we can do about it. Move on.
One effect from what you were saying there, Will, about Max Verstappen, you know, not deserving to have that hanging over his head. Yes, maybe it shouldn't quite have gone in his favour, but, you know, he would have wanted to have won a championship without the asterisk, which I believe is there. The upshot of that might be... Yeah, I know, sorry. But the upshot of that might be that he is...
Led more laps than the entire field combined.
Yeah, that's
why... For the whole season.
That's why race wins are awarded after the first pit stop. Yeah, all right.
Had more podiums than anyone's ever taken in an entire season, won more races than anyone else in the season. But okay, let's put an asterisk against his name.
How about a small one? Can we compromise? Just a little footnote. No,
does Michael Schumacher have an asterisk against his name for 1994?
This would be my second
Danny
argument.
Don't listen to this.
You know what? It's like, you know, and we could be here all night doing this.
So okay, no, fair enough. Like, obviously, everyone's done that argument round and round in circles. I just wonder if the effect is that Max Verstappen is hungrier now than he might have otherwise been. So, listening to his reaction after the second DNF.
No, I don't know, because, you know, he doesn't sit there feeling like he was handed a world championship and he needs to prove himself. You know,
okay.
he did prove himself. He and Red Bull took on the might of Mercedes at their prime, at the very top of what they were doing, you know, which was shown in them winning the Constructors' Championship, and they managed to take the Drivers' Championship, you know, away from them and away from Lewis. I think he feels as though he's done what no one else was able to do in the turbo hybrid era. And that's something very, very special. You can see the frustration in him at the moment over the fact that he doesn't think that he has got the tools to defend that championship. But I don't think there's any feeling over last year. But that's very Max. You know, he doesn't look back. He doesn't dwell on things. He's all in the moment. And you see that in his style of racing as well. He's all in the moment. There is no long-term thinking. There's no reflection back on, you know, sometimes maybe what he's learned. It's all in the now. It's all in the moment. And I think that's where he's at.
So, Alex, you want to come in? Just want to remind you of our pre-show chat, Alex, where you and me said, don't argue with Will about Abu Dhabi. Don't argue with Will.
No, it's fine. You can. Go for it.
No. What I was actually going to say was I actually think we've seen a much more mature Max in these first three races. He's raced really well. Yeah. He's driven really well. Yeah, yeah. He's had a really... It's funny, you know, people think that I'm anti-Max. I'm actually not anti-Max. It's more the people he drives for that I have the issue with. But I'm gutted for Max. I don't want to see him constantly have failures, because all we're going to do is see Charles Leclerc, who I really like, disappear off with the championship, and it will kill the championship dead, where we could actually have a really good championship, because the Red Bulls and the Ferraris are actually close on pace, and I believe Merck will catch up at some point. Not enough to challenge for the championship, but I believe they'll catch up
you
at some
take
point.
Take that back.
And we can have six cars fighting for race wins. Which when was the last time we had that?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, what F1 wanted to do with these new regs was a little bit of learning from the past and drawing influence from the past, you know, to bring it into the present day. And we've got unreliability back. It's great. It's like the 80s all over again, you know? It's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm not sure I quite want to return to watching like early 90s F1 and you go, well, that's the start. That was good. But maybe Gerhard Berger or Alesi's engine will blow up. Oh, look, they did.
Oh, look, Damon Hill's won the Australian Grand Prix by over a minute.
I want to talk about the future of F1, but I used to regularly, even as early as the 2000s, I used to say to people, I'd watch the start of a Grand Prix, have a bit of a nap and then check in to see how it was going, you know, and this is obviously the days when I'd...
A lot of people would.
Yeah, because you'd go out on the Saturday, wake up a bit bleary-eyed. The start was always brilliant and you want it in the background, and then you check on what's happened later on in the race. We're not in that state anymore. No. And no. F1 has changed so much since Liberty Media came in. This feels like almost the end of phase one of Liberty. So, you know, now we've had Avengers Assemble and now we're going to get in towards Infinity War. But the plan that Liberty came in with...
Let's not get into the whole Marvel thing, because then there's going to be, you know, movies are going to get released and you're not sure where they're going to fit into the multiverse or whatever it's called. Or that, you know,
we'll sort all that out in the rewatch with the kids. It'll
and
all
then
shake
there's going to be spin-off series and it's going to be really complicated and confusing. But
ultimately brilliant.
Ultimately brilliant. Yeah. I think I kind of see where you're coming from. I think, yeah, that phase one, and I don't think it's been sort of, you know, written out like this, but I see where your mind is going.
They had like a watching brief to start with, didn't they?
Yeah, that first phase was kind of solidifying you know, figuring out the product that they had, strengthening it, promoting it, pushing it out there, getting this new car online, and then really pushing forward with this. And then, you know, the next juncture will be 2026 and the new engine regulations and the new car that will come in then as well. So yeah, we've got this new kind of like 3-4 year periods with this car and with these engine regs. And so far, you know, so far so good. And it's great. I think what's been great is seeing 10 totally different car concepts of what could have been quite a cookie cutter championship, given how restrictive those regulations were. Every single team has come at this from a completely different angle. We're seeing different circuit characteristics suiting different teams.
Yeah.
A really strong, really close fight in the midfield. We had the potential to see Fernando Alonso on pole in Australia, for heaven's sake. That lap was sensational.
He says he could have won that twice, that race.
He might not have been on pole, but he might have been on the front row. It was that good a lap. And ironically, had he not sort of bullied the new race director into removing that fourth DRS zone, that might have actually sort of helped him out in the race. So
he constantly gets messed about not having DRS zones, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He's the reason for DRS.
He caused all the DRS zones, didn't he, in Abu Dhabi 2012? But yeah, look, the fact is, we won't have those processional races that we were talking about in the 90s. And I don't think we can unfry that egg. I don't think we'll ever go back to that. But there was a feeling perhaps after Bahrain and Saudi Arabia where we go, oh, actually, it's gone so far the other way that we almost don't need that sticking plaster of the DRS that we had before. Then we get to Australia and it all seemed to actually work in a very classic F1 race. It worked out well.
Yeah, but Australia's never been a great racing circuit for Formula One. Like, never. It's never been that thrill ride of a circuit for Formula One. There's just aren't enough overtaking places. It's a great place. It's really fun to go for a race, but they need to make some pretty drastic changes to that track if they want to have some decent overtaking opportunities and some really proper, you know, elbows out racing, because it's just not, it doesn't lend itself to those kind of great races.
But not as the season opener, I had less objection to it than I'd had in previous seasons. So for round three to turn up there and do that. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Because you've had two great races. I think with all the expectation that you'd have in the preseason, then you get to Australia and go, so, you know, you'd wait till you get to Bahrain or wherever the second race would be until you really, you know, formed an opinion about how the season was going to be and how the level of competition was going to be. But that said, I thought it was a great weekend. I thought it was one of the most exciting Albert Park races that we've seen for a long, long time.
A relatively low bar, but yes.
And, you know, and when you take away Leclerc, who was just exceptional, utterly faultless. Behind, there was a race for every single position in the field, and it was really genuinely a good race. You know, I posted after the weekend, you know, that was, I really enjoyed that race, and people were like, "Well, it was really dull. Leclerc won by like big margin," and you're like, "Yeah, but it's not just about the win. Like, a Grand Prix is about every position. It's not just about who's winning the race." I thought it was a really good race.
Are we worried then that people's expectations are just different to how they used to be? So, for example, if you came in from watching Drive to Survive, which we'll go into a bit of depth, you know, later, obviously that doesn't paint the picture of sitting there for 2 hours watching strategy unfold necessarily. Are we worried about people's expectations from race to race? Oh my goodness, what about Monaco when that comes around?
Yeah, that'll be fun. No, I don't think so, really, because it's... I hope that, you know, the commentators around the world do the job of telling the story. And for as long as that commentary and that storytelling lets new fans understand what's going on, why it's interesting, why it plays into the, you know, the wider structure and the wider story of the year, and why things are shaping out as they are, and what to watch out for and what to be excited about, I don't think that's really a worry. And if, you know, if somebody tunes in and says, "I don't find this interesting," well, okay, but then they tune in and they don't find it interesting. You know, we all know Formula One is a labor of love at times. And it's a long-term love, and you ride the rough with the smooth. Not every single race is going to be an absolute classic, but we've had three races this year, which I think have all been really entertaining. Fights for positions, the length and breadth of the field. And actually, I think one of the strong things about Drive to Survive is it has elevated some of the teams and some of the stories that people might not have been interested in. So you might watch Drive to Survive and come into this season as a Williams fan and know that their struggle for a point was so great last year. So to see Albon pulling off that crazy strategy in Melbourne and pull off one point, you're like, well, I know what that means to them. That means a lot. Or you see Haas off the back of last year, get into the opening two races, bosh, scoring points in both races. You're engaged with that. You're in, you know, the Haas mentality of what that means for them. So
yeah, a lot of focus on Tsunoda as well, for example, that you might have got lost in the ether too.
Yeah, or Ocon, and so you're engaged with Alpine or whatever it might be. I think what Drive Survive has done is it's made it not just about the top teams and not just about the fight for the win. It's about the human stories, those personal stories, and some of the teams that might have been lost in the back of the field and a lack of interest in the days before that.
The personal story is what I take from Drive to Survive. I'm actually not interested in when they talk about the season, because so much of it is, we know that the commentary is dubbed over and all that kind of thing. So for seasoned fans who watch every single race, you don't gain anything out of it from that side of things. But
it's not
to see,
for you necessarily.
Like a couple of series ago, what was it? They started the episode up with Daniel Ricciardo. He called Netflix a bad word.
Careful.
And they just used it. And then you just see the personality of people shine out and shine through. And it gets you the ability to be behind the driver, not seeing them drive.
Yeah.
Not just being a fan because they're good or they're bad or they're from your country.
Yeah, you care about them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was all a mistake, and I've told this story a lot, but when they first came in, obviously they wanted to tell the story of Formula One and the World Championship, and Mercedes and Ferrari didn't want anything to do with it. So they had to go and look for the other stories because they couldn't tell the story of the World Championship. And so they found Gunther and Haas, they found Daniel and what was going on at Red Bull with Max and all of those interesting little stories that we remember from season one that created the narratives that have rolled throughout all the seasons. That came out of necessity and out of mistake, because Mercedes and Ferrari were like, no, we don't want this documentary and this film crew anywhere near us. And then season two, Mercedes and Ferrari were like, how much access do you need? Because they saw the benefit of it and what it had done for everybody else in that first season. I think where this last season has had a real difficulty is because for the first time they've had a real championship fight to talk about. And they've never had that before. So getting that balance right between telling the story of the championship and pulling out those personal stories. Like, did the Daniel story, did that need two episodes, or could that have been done in one? Because by doing it over two episodes, you missed an episode where you could have looked at another interesting kind of personal story. So it's, for them, I think it's all about finding that balance and really learning from season four.
Yeah.
And if there's a season five, learning from that and putting together what made the first three great, learning where season four maybe just went off the boil a little bit and pulling it back for the fifth.
I don't know, actually. Like, I did hear some criticism about season four, but so I stopped watching somewhere in season two because I started feeling like, it's entertaining, but it's perhaps not for me. It's not must watch viewing for someone who's been watching F1 for a long time. But I did dip back in. I went, I wonder how they dealt with Abu Dhabi. So I skipped to the last 10 minutes and I saw that and I went, they just told it as it was. That was great. So I did go back to the beginning. And what was interesting was to see you kind of develop, because obviously they know there's a lot of new fans coming in every season. So you've kind of become F1's teacher on Drive to Survive. And the way you have to pitch the level that you're talking to people.
Captain Obvious.
It's very interesting, because obviously we're used to you, Will Buxton, very deep analysis, but then you go on Drive to Survive and you say, if you start at the front, you've got 19 cars behind you. But some people literally might not know how qualifying works.
Yeah, that's one of my proudest lines, to be honest. But it is, honestly, sometimes they ask, a very simple... People think it's scripted. It's not scripted. Yeah. They'll sometimes ask me those questions, like, can you explain why it's important to start from pole position? And I don't think they're ever going to use it. So no. I just kind of look at the camera and just go, well obviously you want to start in pole because then you're ahead of 19 other drivers.
Yeah.
And then they'll just put a nice little pause in the middle and
it's classic. So I've been on the other side.
Off into the middle distance.
I've been on the other side doing these interviews, and so often you cut out the interviewer's question and it's just left with the person saying that. But I think it's all been very kind of endearing and it is pitched correctly at people new to the sport. And so many people love it.
And it's not you know, if you went into any other sport and said, okay, right, let's say 100 meters, Olympic final, Usain Bolt, he's got the fastest qualifying time to make it to the final. Okay, cool. Right. So we're going to line them all up, right? Usain Bolt is going to be on this line here. And then the guy who qualified second, well, he's going to be a meter back. And then the guy who qualified with the third fastest time, he's going to be another meter back. And everyone would look at that and say, but that's insane.
Yeah.
And you're like, you know, but so if you're coming to Formula One for the first time, perhaps you do, you know, you do have to explain the basics of,
yeah,
well, why does the guy in the fastest car and who set the fastest time in qualifying get to start that much further ahead of everybody else in the field? How does that make any sense? And it's, you know, that's part of the job is to open this thing up to new fans. And you see the figures that are going up around the world, crazy. Formula One.
Yeah.
And also for Netflix as well, their figures are going up year on year for the F1 show. So it's clearly doing what it set out to do. And so from that perspective, it's a real positive. And it's been really fun to be a part of it. I do 25 hours of interviews a year for it. If it took me 25 hours to just read a script, I'd be pretty basic at reading a script, but it's five times a year, probably 5 hours, five times a year, just being asked questions. And that's why I say a lot of dumb stuff, because at the start of the year, they're like, who's looking good? And I'll be sitting there going, you know what? I think Aston Martin have got a great design this year. That car's looking amazing. And then we get to the first race of the year and it's,
yeah,
you know,
I did wonder how it was done like that, whether they just caught up with you several times a year. Cause one of the best parts is like Jack Nicholls on there has the most eerily accurate commentary. That's like, do they feed him the lines or do they say, Jack, say something about what happened there?
The prescience.
Yeah. It's Jack, like, how did he know?
I know, right?
He's like an oracle. It was pretty
amazing, isn't it?
getting away from Drive to Survive a little bit, you did mention about the track-specific nature of the design and the teams. Something we were talking about last Sunday was that perhaps with limited resources and less time in a regulation change and having to make the compromise between fighting for previous titles and here, you might have cars that either on purpose or accidentally would suit mechanical grip or high downforce. So this season, more than ever, you're not just going to see perhaps the same three or four drivers and teams fighting for positions. Therefore, you're not only going to see a 7 to 10 place point swing. So you were going to have a lot more variety. And is that as a direct result of the cost cap and the new regulations that teams have had to focus in on, right, we're going to be super good at mechanical grip?
I don't think so, because with a clean sheet of paper, there's an opportunity for anyone to have done a Braun and to come out with that silver bullet, bang, you know, with AlphaTauri, with P1. So no one's going to do what Williams did last year, which was figure out limitations in the car and then just dial in on three circuits for the year that they thought they could score points at. There's no point doing that at the start of a new clean sheet of paper, new set of regulations. You're going to want to create, if you can, a car for all tracks, all eventualities, you know. But I think you're right in that,
like by accident, yeah.
Yeah, and after the first four or five races, once they have learned what the inherent limitations of the car are and where the strengths lie in their car, then they will know which circuits they can maximize their sort of, you know, potential points reach for the season. Now, does that mean they then spend all their, you know, wind tunnel tokens and everything improving and developing the car in other areas, or do they focus very much on those areas where they know they're strong and improve those areas? In the short term, you'd say, yeah, great idea, really cool, except for the fact that this is the first year of a new set of regulations. So you don't want anybody to get away. So you want to try and catch up, and, you know, you need a decent baseline then for 23 and 24. So it's a really interesting, I think, moment right now to try and determine where people will focus and where they'll move. You know, Ferrari already saying they're not going to bring any upgrades to Imola because it is a sprint weekend, because, you know, it's So it's, you know, there's all of these extra little complications to take, to take in and try to work out what you're going to do.
Yeah.
With your rate of development through the season.
So like Ferrari right now, they're in the ascendancy. For them, it's absolutely vital to make hay while the sun is shining and take advantage. But interestingly as well, you've seen like Mercedes go, okay, we're not even going to probably bother with qualifying. We're not that worried. We're setting up fully for the race. Let's be reliable. Let's not blow things up. And I think you might see that throughout the season. You know, cars tip up to a track and go, this isn't suiting our car this week, so we'd best, I don't know, we'll put an extra six wheels on it. We'll make sure we finish 10th and get that point.
Yeah, it's like Haas last weekend. You know, basically just bring the thing home. Don't scratch it. We know we're not going to score any points.
Don't damage
the
engine.
Yeah, not again, please. We might get a lucky point if things happen at the front, you know? And I think that's, yeah, some teams are going to have to do that. And certainly until they know where they're at with the cars and until they've figured out, yeah, where those developments should be spent.
Oh, man, I do love wildly speculating pre-season. And it's like this year, we've got like an extra pre-season because we really don't know which way it's going to go. And we've got a variety of tracks up ahead. It is genuinely one of the most exciting starts to a season in years and years. And since the hybrid era, we just haven't had this.
No.
So people are having to kind of relearn what it's like to not assume the order is going to stay as it is.
I think we sometimes can overlook the fact that this is the largest technical regulation change in Formula One history. You know, every single regulation change that has occurred has been a development, pretty much, you know, piecemeal or slightly larger, a development, sort of a moving on from what went before. This is a wholesale revolution. Rip up what we had before, totally new set of regulations, chuck everything in the skip and start again. And it's fascinating to see who's struggling, who's got it right. You know, no one's got it perfect. And that's the best thing. No one has got this thing 100% on.
Yeah.
Everyone's got something wrong somewhere.
Okay.
And that's just the brilliant part of it.
Will Buxton, you know, I'm a stoic neutral, even to a fault, but you said everyone's got something wrong.
Yeah.
What? I'm just curious, what a Ferrari got wrong, and is it bad? How bad is it? Is it like really bad?
Like, I'm not sure the shade of red is quite.
It's not quite.
Right.
Is that it? No, not like quite, it's not right. The wheels aren't going to just fall off at some point on the grid. No.
Well, there's a lot of debate and discussion about the power unit. Is it on? You know, is it on a par with the Red Bull powertrains / Honda unit? Ferrari saying we haven't quite turned it up as much as we want to yet, and
that's scary.
You know, it is. It's. If there is more to come out of it, and I'm sure there is a lot more to come out of it, then I think it's going to be an incredible season for them. But, you know, their protestations at the moment that they don't have the straight line speed of the Red Bulls could be, I'm not that, and that's not them necessarily getting it wrong, but that's, again, we're talking about playing to the strengths, discovering the ultimate weaknesses of each concept.
We're just going to go to some of our Slack questions that we've collected. Cool. But in our live chat, PD Adams, who I assume is American, has just gone, quote unquote, chuck everything in the skip. Can someone break down this phrase to an American listener, please?
Chuck it in the trash.
Chuck it in the trash. A skip being like a big garbage bin thing, right? But this must be an increasing...
Do they not have skips in America?
Oh, they've got all sorts of weird stuff over there.
What do they call a skip? Well, I'm going to look... Hold on. You find another question. I'm going to look up what is a skip
that's
called
true.
In America.
And I would ask the American listeners, is it true there are no cats in America? Because that's... That's what I've heard. Yeah, there are no cats in America. That's what I've heard. But are you finding something
was that a joke?
Of a children's TV program. I have too many children. Sorry.
Okay.
Two. That's too many. So are you finding that as a problem? Not a problem, but Americans are a different beast. And I think there's probably more American F1 fans now. They're swamping us.
Dumpster fire.
Okay, there
dumpster.
We go.
That's a skip, a dumpster. Sorry.
Okay, if we could just, Steve, if he says it again, can we fix it in the edit? Thanks.
Chuck it in the dumpster.
Yeah.
Set it on fire. right, so what was the question? American audience.
Are you having to change your approach to media for an American audience?
No. I've been broadcasting to the States for 10 years with Speed Channel NBC and... No, not at all. We don't have to call it the straightaway or anything like that. You know, he's on pit road. Don't have to say anything like that. You know, it's all...
They get it. They're like us. They're just like us, really.
Well, the
in
thing
a lot
is,
of ways.
You know, Formula One's terminology is Formula One's terminology. And that's, you know, that's
that's
just
the way it is.
That is the way it is. And the American audience is incredibly passionate and loyal and knowledgeable, you know, you've also got very, very new fans in the US as well. And we were always very conscious of that on NBC too. And we had to be very aware that you could have someone tuning in who'd been watching the sport for 30 years, and you might have someone tuning in who'd been watching it for 30 seconds. And you had to be able to talk to both of them at the same time and not make either one of them turn off or want to turn off, which is always kind of complicated and tricky, but you kind of got to get that balance right. And yeah, it's hard to do, but I hope we're getting it somewhere near right.
Kevin Orozco would like to put you in charge, really. He says, if you were hired to be an advisor to F1 or Liberty Media, what would you like to see in the sport? We're not asking you to say if anything's bad, but just what would you bring to the table as a suggestion?
I would love to have the sprint races as reverse grid race.
Championship start, championship order, reverse.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. I mean, you take Brazil as a really kind of great case in point of having the fast guy at the back,
yeah,
fighting his way through. I would love to see that. Keep the points for that race, because you need the jeopardy. You know, you have to have some form of jeopardy for something. But I know that if you did the reverse grid race, and then you checkered flagged it, and if you started it from the finishing results, then essentially you're just throwing a red flag overnight. So you might have to do what Formula 2 did, which is you have a qualifying session. That qualifying session...
Yeah, I'm trying to keep up.
So the qualifying session would set the grid for the Grand Prix.
Yeah.
But your sprint race the day before could be sort of a small point. You can see I haven't really thought this through.
No, I see what you mean. So I was at Silverstone for the reverse grid... For the sprint race. So we watched qualifying. It was brilliant. It was sort of invalidated the next day when the order changed a bit and Perez dropped it and whatever. And you go, oh, okay, well, now this is the real starting order. What you're saying is qualify on the Friday. That's the starting order for the race. But then on the Saturday, have a reverse sprint and there are some points for it, but it doesn't affect the Grand Prix.
Yeah. Or what you want to do is have qualifying and then you just reverse that whole order and have a sprint race from that. I like the notion of an inverted race because I love seeing the fast guys at the back trying to fight their way through to the front, because we all know that. Okay. So at the moment you put a Charles Leclerc in P20 and by the end of the Grand Prix, he'll probably have worked his way up to a podium place. Like, you know, Lewis would always do it, you know, over the last four, five, 6 years, if he had a bad qualifying, started at the back, you give him a Grand Prix distance and after 90 minutes, he's on the podium or he's won. So I would just love to see that as part of a race. I'd just like to see a trial just to see how that would work out. That would be kind of cool. So
engine regs have sort of given us a taste of that, haven't they? Because as we get towards the end of the season, you suddenly see teams having to take their penalty and drop back. We could just enforce that and go two times a year, you've got to start at the back of the grid.
Yeah, that'd be kind of cool. But no one would sign up for that. Yeah. No one would sign up.
People get awfully upset.
You know what? There's not a lot at the moment in terms of the racing itself that isn't working. I think it's looking pretty good. Oh, the other thing, I would get rid of the 2-lap window for DRS. I think race start, I get it, right?
Mm.
But usually within two laps, people can pull out more than a second gap and then DRS is pointless. So I'd have it one lap and at the end of that one lap, then DRS kicks in, like after a safety car, one lap, then DRS, because like we saw in Australia, you know, after those two laps, there was already like a 1.5 second gap that was 0.8 at the end of the first lap. So you don't need two laps, just one lap in, go DRS. If we're going to have DRS, have it, you know.
I totally agree. I never understood why the 2-lap rule came in initially. Was there ever a real reason behind why?
I'm sure there was. Been lost.
Do you think
somewhere.
It was a safety thing?
Yeah, I think it's. I think it's mostly to do with safety. But if you're in the middle of the Grand Prix anyway, and I think, you know, sort of coming from behind the safety car or race start or whatever, you don't want DRS on the first lap. But I don't think there's any reason for it to be two. I think one lap would be great. But that's just my stupid opinion, you know. I think it'd be great though.
Have it. Actually, a really good question has just popped in the chat room from EJ, because he's pointing out here on Missed Apex, we always say F1 fans should go and turn a wheel at something, sim racing, go-karting. You know, all football fans have had a kick about with their kids in the garden. They understand like the basics. So EJ is asking you, does Mr. Will Buxton, very formal, I like that, buy into this notion? Do you race yourself? I've had the honour of sharing a kart track with you one time, if you remember.
Yeah. I do remember.
You're Alex, a handy is, cut.
Alex is wetting laughing. Himself at the moment.
Well, no, because Alex, you've got to stop, otherwise you have to tell like the whole story. But you know, you fancy yourself in a race car. You were good. You were fast.
Alex or me? Alex is faster than me.
No, not Alex. Those days are gone.
Will, but Will is very aggressive.
No, Alex has got a lot of downforce. So he's good in the corner. He's good in the corners. Terrible on the straights. Got a lot of drag.
Yeah. I was going to say, what era Van Gene are we talking here? Because
when I first met him, he was a lot more draggy. But now
he's gone up and down throughout the years. To be honest,
he's svelte now, isn't he? Look at him.
No, I'm not svelte now.
You're not.
I'm probably one of the biggest I've been, to be honest. Well, I just hide it. I just hide it well. Every time I was anywhere near you on a go-kart track, you were bumping my rear bumper, and this is coming from me
because you were slow and I needed to get past.
You never did, and then cause arguments with other people.
But you must have some great opportunities with these F1 events and the build up to the races to jump into carts with other people from the media and stuff like that. What, didn't you go through New York dressed as Mario?
Tokyo.
That was
great fun. But I've had a lot of great opportunities to, you know, go and kart against, amazing racing drivers. I think I did one, goodness, can't remember how long ago now, with like Sam Bird and Antonio Felix da Costa and loads of people. It's kind of crazy thinking back and people I've karted against, like Jensen and Dario Franchitti and people like that, going way, way back. And then I got to race single seaters a couple of years ago. Well, more than a couple of years ago now. 8 years ago, it's going back a bit, but that was against Latifi and Stroll and Max Verstappen and those guys. So what was that in? Florida Winter Series.
You did a whole series?
No, I just did one weekend at Palm Beach. So
that's good enough though, isn't it?
Tatiana Calderon and Fuoco and Marcello and people like that. That was fun.
And how did you do?
Oh, terribly.
Okay.
I started off like 17 seconds off the pace because I never raced single seaters ever. Mm. And by the end of the weekend was about, I think my fastest lap was about 2 seconds off max. So I'll take it.
Very impressive, to be honest.
I'll take it.
Yeah.
To be honest. And I didn't crash. Well, I spun off a few times, but I didn't dent the car. And if you look on Forex, it will forever say that I finished ahead of Nicholas Latifi in a race. So,
nice.
Did he crash and cause a safety car?
No. I think there was something wrong with his car and he came into the pits and then he came out behind me. But I managed to hold him off for the last two laps of the race.
I have to bring this up because ever since we started talking about karting, the entire chat room has gone mental. So I'm not going to get away with this if I don't ask you. 30th of April, that's the weekend after...
After Miami?
Imola. After Imola, we're karting Dover at LA Park as a missed Apex event.
Is there really?
Yeah, April 30th. You'd be an honored
new track,
guest.
New karts.
Well, I do have my daughter that weekend, so she's going to take precedence.
That's fair enough. But
I'll ask her, do you want to come see some go-karting? And I know what her answer will be, so I will say thank you for the invitation, but I might have to reschedule for another time.
However, you want to take one of the last remaining spots, you still can. So go to www.missedapexpodcast.com/karting. Yes, no Mr. Will Buxton, but you can go toe-to-toe with an end-of-career Alex Van Gene, score yourself a cheeky Stroll-type win against a former good racer. Brad Philpott will be there. Chris Catman-Turner, Chris Stevens will be on commentary. We've got Matt Trumpets flying all the way over from America. Our enigmatic website manager, Felix, will be there. I'll take part. I'll have a little go. I've got my own kit and everything now, thanks to you patrons from my last birthday, of course. So do come and check us out. Ella Park, 30th of April, 4 sprint races all afternoon. And then we'll get massively drunk, I suppose.
The truth is, I just don't want to make Benji cry.
Yeah, this is a bit of a sensitive subject, Will, because I actually beat Alex the last time we went karting, so I was just trying not to...
It's not difficult.
Yeah, I know, but we...
You've never beaten me, Will.
Keep telling yourself that, mate.
I'm going
to
go.
I think I've got the printed results to prove it.
Listen, we've all had a drink. We'll settle this outside later. I've got some listener questions. Sawman17, great question here. I was just talking about this today on the DNF1 podcast. Go and check them out. I was their guest today. What would Will suggest was the best way for bringing new teams and talent into the sport? F1 can't have a promotion relegation system, or can it? Is there any way to change the fundamental structure, the tree of Formula One from a driver point of view? You know, like the FIA has, like football.
What's the best? Are we talking teams or drivers here?
I guess it's two separate questions, really. Can we start with drivers? That's the one that interests me the most. What's the way to get, you know, a tier of like proper driver talent all the way through from top to bottom?
Yeah, you can't do it on age, can you? You can't have an age limit and then retire drivers when they sort of draw their F1 pension. Could you do it on the basis of how many points they've scored in the year? Possibly not. Otherwise, George Russell would have been booted out a couple of seasons ago. It's a really hard one. You know, it's so, so difficult because you kind of look at last year, and I'll say something that's kind of going to be unpopular, but Kimi was basically phoning it in for the year. So, you know, should he have been there last year, or could that seat have been opened up to somebody younger, hungrier, who might have gone out there and, you know, and really given it some? Look at Seb. Does Seb really want to be there this year? Is he going through the motions? I'm not answering that.
No, because I
don't know.
But I felt really harsh. Questions. I said the same thing on Sunday, and I felt so harsh saying that it looked like a farewell tour. And I'm judging. I know he's just come back from illness, but
yeah. I'm glad. You've got to look at that.
Yeah, but he just didn't look hungry. He didn't look like ripped up. He didn't look like ready for a fight. He looked like
I think Seb is incredible. I think Seb is one of the most gifted drivers in the sport. But you kind of last 12 months, he's kind of looked like we all have post COVID, which is, you know, like hair all over the place, hasn't shaved, basically kind of like rolling in his PJs to do a Zoom meeting.
I said earlier today, he looked like us. He looked like us normals. Yeah.
And that, I don't want to sound, that sounds harsher than it should, because I think Seb is fantastic. I think he's genuinely one of the most just insanely talented drivers in the sport, but does he still want to be there? Does he care as much as he did? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is.
Hopefully we're jumping to a conclusion and he's going to pick it up and
fly. I hope so. Because you've got such a huge wealth of talent just waiting in the wings to come through. You know, when you see Oscar Piastri sitting on the pit wall every weekend, you're just like, what is going on, man?
Yeah, that's rough.
But it's so hard. You can't have a promotion demotion. It has to work on merit, but there's so many other considerations to take into effect as well. And as for teams, what would make a difference? Big old bucket of cash, I guess. You know, that's, unless you've got the cash, it's not going to happen. I guess get rid of the 200 mil, you know, sort of dump that you've got to, you know, throw into the FIA in order to even get an entry, and take the decisions away from the teams, because the teams, you know, turkeys don't vote for Christmas. So they're never going to vote for, you know, anybody that could potentially come in and outperform them. Because ultimately, if a new team comes in, like an Andretti, for example, well, and they do well, then one of the existing teams are going to be last, and they don't want that. So they're not going to vote to allow a team in that's potentially going to have decent backing, you know, decent shot of actually doing something good, if they think that they could become last. It's what Paul Stoddart used to say back in the days of Minardi. He said, I am the most important person in Formula One, because without my team, Toyota's finishing last every weekend, or Jaguar's finishing last every weekend, or, you know, whoever is finishing last every weekend. And the big, you know, motor corporations are not going to pay for that. So for as long as Minardi is around to finish last every weekend, and we don't want to be last, but we are last at the moment, for as long as we're here, we're keeping all of those major motor manufacturers in the sport, because they're not coming last. And as soon as they lose us, one of them has to come last. So,
It drives me nuts that the teams and drivers get to vote on stuff that directly affects on-track action. So it's like, every time the drivers moan, I mean, they won't get away with it now, I don't think, but every time the drivers used to moan about particular track limits, they'd widen the track limits. Well, I'm like, no, if they're moaning about track limits, make it narrower. If they're moaning that the tyres aren't good enough, make them worse. Make all the things they don't like harder, because then it benefits us watching it, because it becomes more exciting, because it becomes more difficult. And they're the best drivers in the world, and they should be able to handle this kind of stuff. And the same thing goes for the teams.
Yeah, I'm with you, mate. You know, and we're all racers at heart as well. And I think that is the frustration in the last few years, is the track limits would get written down on the Thursday, and then after free practice one on Friday, they say, oh, well, we've changed the track limits on this corner and that corner. No, you know, white line, edge of the track, that's the limit. Stick to it, you know. And it annoys me when you see, whether it's NASCAR or, you know, whatever the championship might be, kind of like stateside, and they go to Circuit of the Americas, and the penultimate couple of corners, they're just using all the runoff. And you're like, well, that's not the track. You know, you're supposed to be the best. You're supposed to be these incredible racing drivers. If you can't go through, and they're like, oh yeah, but we couldn't go through the corner as fast as we wanted to. It's like, then slow down. That's literally
part of the skill.
Yeah, exactly. That's part of the skill. That's part of why we watch.
It looked awful.
It looks so amateurish on television as well. It looks like you're watching a hatchback track day at Silverstone, where people who don't know what they're doing are driving.
Shout out to...
Yeah, but you wouldn't get away with that.
No, I know. I was going to say.
That's a good point, actually.
You get kicked out, you know? It looks like, you know, it literally looks like you're with a bunch of mates having fun on a, you know, on a computer game. It doesn't look like serious racing. And, you know, I'm with you on that. You know, it's track limits is one of my biggest bugbears. Stick within the limits. Okay. White line, grass, keep it at that. And big curbs that you can't ride.
Why do the teams have so much power? And isn't that worse by the fact that new teams now have to pay £47 billion to get a new entry? Surely that exacerbates it.
It all falls back to... the political situation that existed over the last kind of 10, 20 years, threats of revolution, threats of the Formula One Teams Association as was pulling away, making a breakaway league, all those kind of things. And ultimately the teams, you know, clawing back a bit of a say in everything. And now ultimately having the, you know, the casting vote and the F1 commission, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they tried to make it democratic.
Hmm.
And Bernie always argued it should be, you know, about as far away from a democracy as possible.
Dictatorship, you could say it.
Yeah, Bernie was a benign dictator. He always wanted to sort of class himself as a benign dictator, but he wasn't necessarily so benign. He was quite active. But he always thought that you needed that one person to rule everything. And I, you know, there is an argument for that. There is an argument for, here's the rules.
Mm-hmm.
This is how it is. If you like it, come and play our game. If you don't, go and do something else. And it's, but that, you know, that's just different. That's different styles of governance, which you see in different sports. The way it works in Formula One has worked for a long time. It does work to an extent because you want to get the teams, you know, to be on board with the changes as they're happening. But as we've said, you know, turkeys don't vote for Christmas, so they're never going to be voting for something that ultimately holds them back or stops their run of competitiveness.
I'm with Bernie on this one. I run Miss Apex with an iron fist. It's the Spanish way. Or no way. I, you know, people say stop Van Gien headbutting the microphone all the time. I say no, I want that. I like that content, and he will be doing that as long as I decide he will be. Sean has a good question here, and this is a bit more personal, Will. I'd be interested to know who were his heroes, your drivers and teams as a lad. Obviously, brackets, I know he's staunchly unbiased since becoming a professional pundit, which is an interesting point all in itself. Let's start with ages. Let's be rude. Van Gien is something like 37... 36,
just 30. Turned 38.
Just turned 38. Jeez, that's old man. I'm 41/31, depending on if you're talking to me or my agent. Where in that bracket are you, Will? Similar?
41.
Same as me. Same era. Who were your heroes as a lad in F1?
Senna. Senna was my hero. Yeah, he's what got me into F1. And then Damon Hill.
Yeah.
Damon was massive for me. And that was kind of it. They were my two big heroes. I don't think I didn't really have any others. They were the ones.
I'm disappointed that I actually wasn't a Senna fan at the time. But then looking back, he's been built up as such an icon that I feel like the urge to go, oh yeah, no, I definitely was all in on Senna. But somehow it felt like in real time it didn't quite play out like we look back on it.
Yeah, but we forget, like, Senna wasn't roundly loved in the UK.
He was seen as arrogant, wasn't he?
The whole Mansell Mania thing. And I've seen photos of Silverstone and, you know, someone had a noose. They had a hangman's, you know, the wooden thing, and and a noose hanging from it, and a dummy of Senna hanging from it in the crowd at Silverstone. But, and so we all see that lovely photo of Mansell picking up Ayrton and driving him back at Silverstone. That wasn't just a Pally thing. It was because they were baiting for Senna. Like, they hated him, and Nigel was picking him up to get him away from the, you know, the sort of the baying mob. There was a lot of hatred towards Ayrton in Britain. There's a lot of love for him, you know, in the motor racing quarter, but Mansell mania became, you know, I wasn't really into it that much at the time.
What?
But
why?
What, Mansell mania?
Yeah. I was sucked in. I was. Red 5.
You really? Yeah, it was all a bit. Red 5, yeah. I don't know. It was all it just.
My dad was a Mansell fan, so I liked Mansell as well. It's funny though, but obviously I'm obviously a little bit younger than you guys, but I
really
I,
nothing in it.
I never really grew up with much proper fandom. It was just a case of I'll follow the British guy.
Yeah, default. Yeah.
So it was Mansell, and then it was Hill, and at that age, it was who my dad followed. And it wasn't until I properly started watching F1 on my own that I then found the people I liked. I liked Montoya, or anyone
Juan Pablo but Schumacher.
Anyone but Schumacher, yeah, I was in that.
for me, Montoya was the best driver to ever not win a title, and that's even against
Go on, say the names, Alex. That's how podcasting works.
Off my head, who should have won a title and didn't win a title, and he gave it away.
Sterling Moss.
Sorry, my brain went. Yeah. And
Pablo Moss. Montoya better than Sterling Moss. That is a bold claim.
Yeah. Okay. Here's an interesting one.
Feedback at missedapex.net, because Matt picks up those emails. So I don't have to deal with that.
Here's an interesting question then, Will. Okay. So when it comes to talking about best drivers ever, do you not just believe the drivers we have now are always better than the drivers that we used to have, because they're better prepared, they do more testing, they're younger, they're fitter, and they have so much more data, which makes them better drivers? So it's like, for example, Fangio is a legend of the sport, and I'd never say anything against that, but he was in his late 40s when he was driving in F1. There's no way he would turn up in F1 these days and be as good as the stars that we've got now.
Okay. So we all laud the amazing Mille Miglia win that Stirling Moss had with Jenks alongside him. But what isn't often written about is the fact that I think something like 15 minutes back or 20 minutes back from Jenks and Moss was Fangio. But Fangio didn't have a co-driver because his co-driver had been killed the year before, and he swore he would never put anyone's life at risk again. So he did the Mille Miglia with no pace notes, and finished about 20 minutes slower than Moss and Jenks. Don't tell me that's not incredible. And that's not using all of your data and your training and everything else. Like, that's just being an epic driver. Like, is Pelé and Cristiano Ronaldo, right? Ronaldo would eat Pelé for breakfast, right? Yeah. But who's a better footballer? You know, the football Pelé was playing with, you know, it was like a bloody medicine ball from the gym, you know, less more than it was a football. You're dealing with apples and oranges. And it's this thing that, you know, got traipsed out again by the Sun yesterday, the Jackie Stewart quote from 2 years ago, by the way. I don't know why they put that article out again.
I'm guessing clicks.
Yeah. But it's so, you know, and the fact that the headline said, you know, Lewis Hamilton isn't the best of all time, says Sir Jackie Stewart. So everyone goes, why aren't you calling him Sir Lewis Hamilton? It's like, because they've literally just recycled an article from 2 years ago when he wasn't Sir Lewis Hamilton. And also, and it, you know, and the quotes are from 2 years ago anyway. But Jackie basically saying Fangio's the greatest of all time, because to Jackie, Fangio was the greatest of all time, right? Like, said Lewis, Ayrton's the best of all time. Lewis isn't going to look at himself and go, I'm the best of all time. He's always going to say Ayrton's the best of all time. And when Lewis is 70 years old and some new kid on the block has just taken his 12th Formula One World Championship and obliterated all of Lewis's records, Lewis will probably sit there and go, still reckon Ayrton was the best of all time, you know? And people will go, ah, oh, Hamilton's got no respect, you know, yeah, know. This. Because it's, I think you know, you just, it's so hard to compare eras. I think in any sport, it's almost impossible to compare eras because so much changes, but you know, none more so than Formula One. The circuits have changed, the technology's changed, the speeds they're driving at has changed, the levels of danger have changed. Every single facet of what makes this sport has changed. So you can't, I don't think you can compare it. I think it's impossible. But in terms of raw ability of being able to jump into a car and drive the wheels off it, I think you'd have to go far to get any better than Mario Andretti and Stirling Moss. I think you could put them in anything and they'd win.
I personally think that Lance Stroll would do better than Ayrton Senna or Alain Prost. But we don't have time, unfortunately, for a counter to that. We're going to have to move on and head towards the end of the show. But I would like to end, Will, by asking you a little bit about life as Will Buxton. And Sean sort of touched upon it a little bit there, talking about, having to sort of, you've obviously got your F1 fan brain and then you have to go into a journalistic mode. But I'm happy to admit here, I'm nothing like Will Buxton level. I'm spanners in a shed. But at the end of, not even the end of last season, about two-thirds of the way through, I actually let myself get physically ill at just the weight of interaction we got from Verstappen fans and Hamilton fans. One week we would not be Hamilton enough. One week we would be too anti-Max or too pro-Max. And the weight of it just all hits you like a tidal wave until you realise, oh, wait, it's not personal. I've got to somehow park that and move forward. And that's without being Will Buxton. How on earth do you manage that at the very centre of F1?
Transcendental meditation.
Right, okay. That's the tantric thing, right? No?
No, that's different.
Okay.
Yeah, very, very different. lots of things, really, but
he's not Rod Stewart.
No, I had to really separate myself from it because under lockdown as well, I wasn't in a very healthy place. I wasn't really, and I definitely wasn't dealing with social media very well. And I had to take some time off last year because it did get too much and did get too heavy, and it was really affecting me. And I'm much better at dealing with it now. I think the winter was really, really hard after Abu Dhabi was really, really hard because it was constant and it got very, very personal. And that did get, people sort of sending messages like, why don't you go and kill yourself? And I'm going to find where you live and I'm going to kill you and all this. And you're like, well, this is unexpected. Mm. And you can't comment on it because if you do comment on it, people go, you're just getting abuse.
Yeah, you're like, snowflake. Well,
why am I getting abuse anyway? And also I am getting it. Here's a photo of it. But I'm just doing my job. And my job is to talk about this thing that I love. People wanted me to express an opinion after Abu Dhabi on what I thought went down. And they wanted me to... Basically, they wanted me to agree with them. They wanted me to tell them that they were right. They didn't want my opinion because if I'd given them an opinion that wasn't the opinion that they shared, they would have told me that I was a shill and that I was part of the problem. So they didn't want my opinion. Yeah. They just wanted me to add to the noise. And I refused to do it. And because they said, you know what went down. We all know what went down. I was like, well, you don't know what went down because you weren't in that room. And there was only one person that was in that room. And until he comments or until we see the report on what went down in that room, every single opinion over this wasteland of Twitter is based on conjecture because no one was in that room. So your opinion, which is based solely on your disappointment in how that race panned out, is based on nothing. It's based on conjecture. And that was really, really frustrating. And because I said I wasn't going to express an opinion on it, I was literally getting death threats. And you're like,
mad.
This is
it's
insane.
Absolutely mad.
It's insane.
Yako said, how does the hype not fatigue Mr. Buxton? The most emotional season became a long-term emotional flip-flop. I tell you what, the advice people always say to me when I'm getting grief, nothing on that scale, is, oh, just ignore it. But it's impossible because you're there in a professional capacity.
But it's like, if someone walked up to you on the street and just went, you're an idiot, you'd just be like, I have no idea who you are, but have a nice day. Yeah. And you'd go about your day. But if it, when it's kind of being sent at you online, it's difficult. And, you know, you could be sent 100 lovely messages with people saying, I love what you do and it's really great. And you get that one that just goes, you're a dick and I hate you. You're like, you want to reply to that one and say, no, but why? What can I do? How can I change your opinion? And how can I turn this round? And it's always the negative one that hurts. And it's always the negative one that you reply to. Mm. And then you give it oxygen. Why are we drawn to this negativity to give it oxygen? And also, but the other question, like with social media, who's got the time to what are these people doing? But like to go onto social media and search for somebody and then just go, oh, I'm going to tell them that I hate them. Like, you're just wasting your own time. Like, what are you doing? Why do you not have anything better to do than that? It confuses the hell out of me, man.
And people do it. I just want to say that sitting on this, obviously Alex is here as well, on the panel, all our panelists, even though they're all just giving up their time as volunteers, do get a ton of abuse. Alex gets the second most abuse from anyone on our panel, which is quite fun. Brad Philpott gets the most by a long way.
it's only because we don't hide the fact that we're Lewis fans, and we didn't hide the fact that we weren't happy with a lot of the way Matt's conducted himself during races last season.
Yeah,
and
I know.
That's the whole part of it. I have massive respect for the speed that Max Verstappen has. Mm. I don't think the team he is at is the best environment for almost any driver, because it seems like a very hostile, sort of attacky kind of place, and can turn nice drivers into different people. So you see all the stuff on social media with Max, especially when he was with Daniel Ricciardo. They're great together. Yeah. And it was always great fun. Every interview we see with Max is always great fun. But it's like there's a different person being driven on the circuit. And when we saw an issue, we called it.
I think Max's greatest strength is also his greatest weakness. And that is the fact that the team tell him he can do no wrong. So it gives him that kind of unbeatable mindset of, well, I'm right. You know, this is the whole world's against me. And I have to prove them wrong. And I'm going to go out and I'm going to race the way that I race. And they're going to like, yeah, you race the way that you race. Everyone else is wrong. You're right. And that gives him this incredible strength. But then when it all goes wrong, they'll turn around and rather than say, yeah, you probably should have done that differently, they'll go, no, everyone else is wrong and you're still right. So it's, I do see that. I do, you know, and it is, we know it's a difficult situation there. It's never been easy at Red Bull, but I firmly believe his, you know, what makes his biggest strength is also his biggest weakness.
It's interesting. I was listening to a different podcast with Mark Priestley, and Mark Priestley was saying the exact same thing that you've just said about Lewis when he first joined McLaren, which was no one ever told him he did something wrong. He was surrounded by yes men. And it was only once he got past that, he then started to actually not trust the people who just told him he was right all the time. And maybe Max is in a different environment where he's just being lauded all this praise on, and he's not all of a sudden seeing it as, oh, maybe I should look at it from another angle.
Oh, man. That sounds great. Being surrounded by yes men sounds fantastic. But I would have to dump every single person on the Missed Apex panel to get to that point. Will Buxton, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for being so honest about the effects of social media, because honestly, it was something that was such a big challenge to me as a noob and in media relatively. So it's nice to know that someone who's been Will Buxton as long as you've been was also feeling those effects.
Well, it just, you know what, it can be such a horrible place for people to be. And, you know, the internet was supposed to set us free, you know, it was supposed to give us unlimited information and lead to, you know, incredible dialogue and debate and knowledge. And it's just turned into people being horrible to each other for the sake of it. And I don't know how we turn it around. I don't know how we get back to a place of kind of understanding. And I don't want to sound all soppy or anything, but I hate it, because the Formula One community at its heart and at its soul is full of good people who love this sport. You know, the first time I ever went to a Grand Prix, I remember being a kid and standing on the banks at Silverstone down at the old club corner and surrounded by people of different nationalities, waving different flags, different teams different and different fandoms, drivers. Yeah. And you were all united by your love of the same thing. There was none of this fractious, divisive, negative anger that exists now. And I just want to get back to that place of respecting each other, the love that we have for this sport, and that's what unites us, and realizing we can have different opinions. It's all right. We don't have to agree all the time. And just because someone has a different opinion than you, it doesn't mean they're a horrible person. Doesn't mean you have to get angry with them. Like, just get on with your day. It's all going to be okay.
You know? I'd like to echo what Mr. Buxton said just there. You know, get on with supporters of all teams and drivers, not you, Ferrari. Stand down. Okay, just to end on a quieter note, on a lovelier note, just finally...
You're going to have a bad season with that kind of negative Ferrari vibe here, my friend. I can tell you that.
It's already started being bad, Will. Have you seen the last three races? It can't get any worse for people who think Ferrari is the Death Star and should never, ever win. I do have one last question that hopefully will be on a lighter note. I've seen you do these very imaginative, like, interview things. Obviously, if you're doing interview after interview for year after year, sometimes it becomes a, you know, let's juggle knives whilst we juggle petrol-covered flame balls at the same time whilst we ask you questions about the season. So obviously, you have to do these setups for these fun interviews over the last 5 or 6 years. You know, who are the guys that are really genuinely up for that and a joy to interview and do that stuff with?
So it's kind of like, we've never gone in for the whole playing Jenga or darts
or milk while driving around with milk.
Yeah, or any of that kind of stuff. I like to just, I like to have a proper sit down with a driver and have a proper one-to-one. It's been really hard with COVID because we've not had that close personal interaction that we used to have in years gone by. But I honestly, each driver has their own unique way. And ultimately, it's about learning who they are and what they like, and talking to them about what they enjoy. You know, Lewis doesn't like talking about Formula One. You talk to him about anything other than Formula One, and he opens up. Mate, he's been asked for 15 or more years about the setup, the bloody tires, the track condition. Like, he's done. Like, ask him about something he's interested in, and he blossoms.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. I bet there's a lot of other drivers like that as well. Like, you know, Ricardo has a lot of outside interests too. So
All of them. You know, they're all fascinating individuals who have their loves and their interests outside of Formula One. If you can open them up on that stuff, they're incredible. But then you also get to know their intricacies, that when you do have to ask them the boring stuff, not the boring stuff, you know, the stuff that there is.
F1.
The bread and butter stuff that they get asked a billion times, you know, and when they're in that pen and there's 12 TV crews or 20 TV crews and everyone's got two questions, you guarantee those two questions will be probably identical. If you can come up with something that's just a little bit different and plays to something that they like and that they're interested in as well, and would do it in a way that is personal to them, then they can open up a bit.
So here's a question then. It's Will Buxton's last day in Formula One. He's got one more interview to give, and he's got an hour to spend with anybody in the paddock who's there. Could be a driver, could be a team manager. Who's your last interview with that you really want to enjoy and have fun with?
Oh, that's tough. I would either Seb... Lewis, Seb, if I got an hour and it was properly, they're going to be absolutely honest and not hold anything back and just and give me everything. Seb or Lewis, because Seb, I think, is one of those morally guided, down to earth, proper people that I've ever met, and I think there's a lot in his career in Formula One that we don't understand fully. Decisions he took, reasons he did things, reasons he raced in a certain way that I would love to get under the surface and really hold a mirror up and get to know that, you know, deep under his surface, who he is. And the same goes with Lewis as well. I don't think anybody knows the real Lewis. I don't know if Lewis knows the real Lewis. And
oh, that's deep, man. Whoa.
No, well, you know, I think he's struggled for so long to be what everybody wanted him to be. I'd just like to have a really long, proper chat with him.
Nice.
But I don't think you could do that with the cameras on. So I think I just, if I had that hour, I'd have the cameras there and the microphone and just burn everything straight after.
Well, for us, it's felt like that, having an hour and a bit with you, Mr. Will Buxton. This is the part of the show where we would normally plug your social media, but frankly, I'm not sure. We will put a link to your Twitter and stuff in the show notes below, but really,
thank you, mate.
I'll just leave by saying it's amazing that you will spend your time, you know, interviewing Lewis Hamilton and Sebastian Vettel one moment and then come and speak to us in the shed. We are fantastically grateful.
I love the shed.
We're fantastically grateful. We hope you'll come back at some point and hope you have a great week and a great weekend at Imola.
Thanks, mate.
Fantastic. If you want to continue listening to Missed Apex podcast, not just because Will Buxton was here that one time, we'll be here on Sunday with a new show. And then on Tuesday, we're catching up with Sean Kelly, F1 Statman. So we'll be collecting your questions on F1 statistics. Until we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.